danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 274 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Melrose, Massachusetts, I'm Nate Mavis, and with me from...
Baltimore, Maryland at the moment. We'll be leaving here very shortly, but Baltimore,
Maryland. Bang. Baltimore, Maryland. No suburb, just the place. Oh, fantastic. how are you, Andrew?
I'm doing pretty well. How about yourself?
I'm really great, really great. Beautiful fall weather here. Life is good.
Yes, here as well. So today's guest is coming to us courtesy of John the Lawyer. Some of you have probably heard our interviews with him. If you haven't, you should, especially our first interview with him. That's an episode that I often think back on as one of our better ones. But he's also recommended a lot of people who've been at least among my favorite guests. And this particular person is someone with whom John plays a couple days a week at Foxwoods. The person actually asked us not to use his real name, so we'll just call him John Doe for now. But this is a person who's had really tremendous success in the business world prior to retiring. I think he said 89 in the interview, 89 years old now. Still playing like 18 hours of poker a week, or really in 2 days, in a 2 day stretch, which is pretty impressive. Probably more than I play in many weeks. So he was formerly on the board of directors at American Airlines. He's been a CEO. He was the executive vice president an executive vice president at American Express. So quite high up in some pretty defining American corporations. And we talked some to him about that experience and kind of how it relates to poker, how he thinks about his own poker playing now, and you know what skills he does and doesn't use from poker. And I liked how kind of I guess blunt was the, you know, like he would pretty willingly give like yes or no answers to just like, do you use your poker skills in business? No, you know, stuff like that. It was I enjoyed talking to him.
Yeah, certainly me too. It reminds me in a funny way sort of our interview with Ike Haxton, which would have been like 5 years ago now or something, where it's just like sort of like peeking at the back of the math textbook or something, like where the answers are or whatever. It's like, so do you think this is important? No. It's yeah, like, exactly. What should you do here? Make sure you don't check too many of your hands. Oh, okay, good. It's like, thanks, Ike. You know, it's like, what's it like to work in a spring factory? Remarkably interesting, but also hard.
So it was awesome talking to him. I appreciate his taking the time. So thank you to Mr. Anonymous Guest. And also thank you to John for setting it up. We got to get John back on here. We were actually, if this interview had fallen through, we were going to talk with John instead. So hopefully we can get him on real soon. It's been too long since we've had him on here.
Yeah, John's great.
One quick thing I wanted to ask you, because I remember you recommended this on the air a couple of years ago when the first season of Serial was still on. Have you been listening to the third one?
I have not. Season 2 was so bad.
That's what I heard. I never even tried on season 2.
That's very good. I was like, I don't do a lot of hate listening. By the end, I was, oh no, it's...
I mean, honestly, like, even by the end of season 1, I was liking it a lot less. Like, I felt like it started with a lot of promise, but I didn't feel like season 1 closed very strongly.
No, I don't think it... No, I don't think so. I think the story is great. I think I have a lot of respect for Sarah Canning's sort of life of work that put her in contact with stories like that. When she was telling the story, I thought it was just fantastic. When it was like sort of her pontificating about things, I thought it got a lot weaker. Right. And I think season 2 had a little more of that. Yeah. And again, like much respect. I mean, I love season 1. And I've heard great things about season 3.
Yeah, not just from you. I'm enjoying it a lot. I mean, enjoying is probably not quite the right word, but I think, you know, what she says anyway was sort of the purpose of the project. You know, a lot of people were asking her, like, well, what lessons can we learn after doing the Anand Sayed case in season one? People were saying, like, well, what lessons can we learn about the justice system from this? And she kind of thought, well, A, that was a very unique case that's probably not that illustrative of, like, broader issues in the justice system, and B, like, looking at any one case is probably not going to provide that as much. So this is kind of like, I mean, it's she says it like one case at a time. I'm not sure exactly how to describe it, but essentially it's like a documentary of spending a year around the justice system in Cleveland and looking at much more kind of run-of-the-mill cases to make points, not so much about those individual cases as just about kind of what's actually happening in a lot of, like, cash-strapped urban justice systems, which I would say, like, as someone who is sort of probably more informed than, like, the average person who doesn't work in those things, but, like, not someone who's had, you know, direct contact with it in any way, none of it is, you know, like, oh, I had no idea. But the, sort of the extent of it and the details of it are still pretty eye-opening, I guess.
Yeah, that's good. Can I also say I really liked S-Town?
Oh, I have not read, or I have not listened to that.
Yeah, I liked it. It's, yeah. So,
good. If you get sick of us, there's some suggestions.
Yeah, yeah.
Or I know there's some people listening where, you know, our hour a week or whatever of content, that's us like one day off of their commute. So I know we've got some people who are serious podcast listeners out there. And
yeah, I've been a quick shout out to Tell if he's listening. He's a truck driver. And like he said, like, oh, can you recommend me anything to listen to about poker? I said, well, let me tell you, I host a podcast. He said, oh, okay, I'll be done in a month. I was like, you know, there's a lot of archives. He's like, no, I'm a truck driver. It's cool. yeah, very smart. Yeah. By the way, I know I've said this before. Like, a lot of my favorite emails have been emails of the form, like, I have a job, whatever, stocking soup cans or something, and like, it's pretty boring, but I'm allowed to listen to things, and I discovered your podcast, and in the last 3 months, like, I've listened to the whole run of your show twice, so thanks. And it's like usually something like, whoa, you're a sick puppy, but then, yeah, obviously very grateful. I think it's really it's really uplifting for me to know that people want to listen to the show that much, or that much of the show. And especially, I have worked a lot of jobs where I was grateful for diversions. So to be that kind of diversion for somebody else, I feel like I'm paying it forward a little bit. So
awesome. So this one's for all the stock boys out there.
Yeah. And, you know, stock people.
Stock ladies, stock people. That's right. Stock folk.
There we go. With an X.
We've got a question about tournament poker strategy coming up, and if you want to learn a lot more about tournament poker strategy, the place to do that is Tournament Poker Edge. Tournament Poker Edge is where you'll find hundreds of videos from dozens of instructors, myself included, covering a wide range of tournament poker concepts, including the idea of survival, Chippy V, ICM, all concepts that are going to come up in our upcoming strategy segment. Start your subscription at www.tournamentpokeredge.com. This one is coming to us from Dan. Dan says, hey guys, I'm primarily a cash game player and don't play a lot of tournaments, but I suspect that there are some situations in tournaments where the best play is radically different from what might be considered the best play in cash. I want to run a situation from a recent tournament past due that I've been thinking about. The hand comes from a $400 buy-in WSOP circuit event at Foxwoods. We are nearly at the bubble, 56 players remain, and 54 make the money. The blinds are 2,500, 5,000, with a 5,000 big blind ante. I'm on the button with ace-king offsuit and about 130,000 chips, so 26 big blinds. It folds to the hijack, who has about 700,000 chips. I don't have any reads, but he is the biggest stack at the table. He raises to 20K, four times the big blind. And so our hero is on the button now with ace-king offsuit, facing a raise from a big stack on the hijack who's opened 4X, and he has ace-king, and we're on the bubble. And so his question is essentially, I can read the whole thing later, but he kind of rules out re-raising less than all-in, and which I think is correct, and kind of boils it down to shoving or folding. I think the central point here is what to make of the 4X, like what sort of player this is. I mean, I would say in general, if you told me, you know, hijack opens, I have ace-king on the button, even if it's the bubble, I still think it's a shove. But I mean, it does come down to having fold equity. Do you agree with that part?
Yes, it does. I mean, I think at Foxwoods, like, I think there are a lot of players there for whom 4X means like, I really have something. But like, ace-king is so good against the, like, I really have something range.
Yeah.
I don't know. And does he have so much that he can call it off, like, with ace-queen? Like, it'd be really great to... I mean, it wouldn't be really great. I guess that's the whole crux, is like, if you shove, like, do you even want to call from ace queen? Probably, that's the thing. It's not a satellite. Like,
yeah, I think you still want the call from ace queen. You don't want to call from like jack 10 suited.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you definitely don't. So I think that'll work out like in your favor, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I want to
address, I mean, I think it's a shove.
Yeah, I want to address one thing here, which is I think that there's some people, and this is an idea that used to kind of go around the tournament world. I mean, I remember seeing this in the MTT forums back in the days. I think there's an idea out there that you should play to win, and that like playing to cash is weak tight or something like that. And that's broadly true. I mean, I think a lot of people take survival too far or worry too much about not wanting to get eliminated. That said, when you're very close to the bubble, and we don't actually know the payout structure for this tournament, but I think this is true of virtually all tournaments these days, you know, the payouts tend to be a relatively large difference between, you know, in this case we're paying was it 54 players, so there's typically a pretty large difference between 55th and 54th place, you know, something like two buy-ins. And then once you're in the money, the gradations thereafter until you get to the final table tend to be quite small. So often it'll be something like, you know, 54 through 46th get, you know, 2.1 buy-ins, and then 64th through 70, or I keep doing that backwards, 45th through 37th get like 2.3 buy-ins. It's sort of like that you're incrementally doing better once you're in the money tends not to be that important relative to getting into the money in the first place. You know, when you're talking about pay jumps at the final table, those are meaningful, but I would say it's typically more important to make sure that you get into the money once you're on the bubble than it is to increase your likelihood of having a lot of chips when you get into the money, but also increase your likelihood of getting eliminated on the bubble if you care about maximizing your EV. I mean, some people have other reasons for wanting to win tournaments, which is entirely fine and up to you while you're playing, but I don't think it's necessarily the case that, you know, the way to maximize your EV is always play to win.
Yeah. Yep. Well said.
So, I mean, I think you do have to assess, you know, like, it's important to think about the risk of getting eliminated here. And I can imagine some players that I guess I would fold this to. I mean, it depends a little bit on what you see your edge going forwards as well. But as you said, Nate, I mean, ace-king does so much to block the hands you really don't want to run into. I mean, it's really not a big problem unless you run into aces or kings. I mean, you wouldn't want to stick it in here like ace-king versus jacks, or even ace-king versus jack-10 suited, but it's not the end of the world if that happens. I mean, you're not losing that much if you end up getting called by jacks. Running into aces or kings is where obviously what's really going to be bad for you, and ace-king blocks those pretty hard. In terms of like worst case scenarios or near worst case scenarios, they're not that bad. And you know, picking up, there's a lot of money in the pot at this point. I mean, increasing your stack by 25%, even on the bubble, I mean, that is meaningful. It's not worth as much as increasing your stack by 25% earlier in the tournament, but it is still, I mean, those chips are worth a lot of money.
Yeah. Yep.
So the full analysis from Dan here, he says, Given my stack size, re-raising 3x basically means I'm shoving the flop, so I might as well shove pre to take whatever fold equity is there, so I rule out re-raising anything less than all-in. I broadly agree with that. I mean, I can imagine some cases where, like, maybe you think your opponent's going to interpret it actually as stronger if you re-raise, you know, less than all-in, but I think it's true. You shouldn't really be re-raising and then folding at any point. So probably sticking it in, especially on the bubble where you want maximum fold equity, probably makes sense. Mm-hmm. He also says, shoving is not appealing. If I shove, the ideal situation is to get a call from an ace-x or king-x kind of hand, or a fold, which might happen some of the time, though I have blockers. What I wouldn't want to do is flip for my tournament life versus a pocket pair, or even go up against a hand with 40% equity like a middle suited connector. As villain is a big stack opening from late-ish position, it's perfectly reasonable for him to have this kind of hand and call my shove. I suppose the thing to do is weigh the probabilities of villain having each of the above hand types, ace-x, king-x, pocket pairs, suited connectors, and junk, and proceeding accordingly. But I don't have any reads, and this is a rare decision point for me given my sparse tournament participation, so I elected to fold. I think his analysis is basically right there, and I think he's right that that is the thing to do, is you kind of weigh the possibility of running into these different types of hands. And you know, he kind of glosses over the fold equity, which is the only thing I would say is a bit of a mistake. He kind of says, well, you know, nice to get called by an ace or a king, and I guess it'd be nice to get a fold, but I blocked the ace or king X hands. I mean, the fold, you should be getting folds a decent amount of the time here. And that would be the main thing that would deter me from shoving, is if I thought the hijack were just like a very, very tight player, or that the 4X was incredibly meaningful from him. But as long as you have some fold equity, I think it's unlikely you're going to go wrong shoving here, because you're not going to be in very bad shape when you're called. Last thing he says.
Yep.
Calling. And
Sorry,
go ahead.
Just on a psychological note, on the bubble, it kind of feels like a lot of the tournament's done, and it sort of is, but mostly it isn't. Yeah. It's, you know, good for you making it that far, but, like, you know, really, there's a long way to go. Like, the idea of busting, like you have to win a lot of chips. You don't want to bubble. Like, it's really bad to bubble. Like, if you knew he had jacks, you would just fold. Or call, I guess. but the other thing I want to say is calling is better than folding. I'd rather raise, but if I couldn't raise, I would very happily call, because ace-king is really good, and you have position. So that's that.
Dan does address calling. Let's hear out his argument here. He says, calling is also a possibility. If I call, there will be 52-5 in the pot with 110K effective. A half pot flop bet means I'm all in on the turn. So if I miss the flop and he continues his aggression, I'm probably folding, and I've chopped my stack down 4 big blind. Ace King never really truly misses the flop entirely. If it doesn't make a pair, it almost always has a draw, but there's no drawing with this stack size, so Ace King loses some of its appeal in this regard. Minus 4 big blind isn't a tragedy, and I might view this as the second best choice given the situation. What do you think of that?
I think it's the second best choice. Calling. Yeah. Yeah. The thing is, like, oh, he's probably going to miss. Like, if he bets the flop, that's bad. It's like, is he betting the flop all the time? In that case, that's awesome. You have position, and he's effectively, like, you're effectively calling a lot of money with a little bit of money. Like, that's really, like, yeah. If he's committing to betting the flop, that's, like, great for you, right? And if, I don't know, and like, if he isn't always betting, then he isn't always betting. I don't know. Then, like, if he is always betting, sometimes you hit the flop. That's great. Flop comes 4 deuce deuce. And if he's always betting, you're still a mile ahead. So I don't know. You have position. Don't be so pessimistic. Yeah. Calling is fine.
The way that I often put this to people, you know, especially when I'm coaching, the advice I'll give them is, don't fold to bets that haven't been made yet.
Yeah.
You should be, like, thinking ahead to what could possibly happen, but like you said, it's only a possibility. Either he's always betting the flop, in which case you can pretty profitably call or shove over a flop bet, or he's not always betting the flop, in which case you might have a tougher decision and or end up folding if he does bet the flop, but it's not always going to happen. And so I think that's the case. Too often people tend to ask themselves, especially as they start to get shallower, they start to ask themselves, well, if I can't take this hand all the way to showdown, then I guess I just won't play it at all. And the problem with that is that it really rewards, I mean, this is even more true with flop bets. I think a lot of times you see people, you know, they're reluctant to call a bet with something like middle or bottom pair on the flop because they're like, well, if he keeps betting, I'm going to have to fold. And, you know, he may not keep betting. And the problem with giving him so much fold equity on a single bet, I mean, similar to what we're getting here with the preflop raise, a lot of people actually don't do a very good job of barreling or following through. And a very common strategy still in 2018 is c-bet the flop and then give up if you don't have anything. So when you sort of assume that your opponent is always going to keep barreling and you just go ahead and fold now, then you're really rewarding those players who do bet once and give up because they end up playing correctly against you. They get all the fold equity they're going to get by betting the flop. And then if you call the flop, they have information that says you're probably going to showdown and they can correctly stop bluffing when they have weak hands. So this really, I think, plays straight into the hands of a common strategy. You know, it's exploitable not only by opponents who can like observe you and see that this is what you're doing, but it's just exploitable by people who are playing kind of fundamentally wrong strategy, but you end up playing straight into their hands.
Yep. Well said.
Anyway, results from Dan. He did fold. He ended up advancing to day two and finishing 11th. He says, I was pleased with this result. I do think back and wonder whether I made a big mistake folding the ace-king. It's easy and erroneous to look back and think I made the right choice. So yeah, I think it's great that he's willing to look back over this, you know, not in a results-oriented way, despite getting a result I'm sure he would have been happy with if you told him when there are 56 players remaining, you know, you're going to get 11th. Like, if you fold here, then, you know, he would probably want to do that. But, to still go back and look at this hand, despite the fact that folding seemed to have worked out pretty well for him, I think that speaks very well to his ability to improve as a player.
Yeah, I mean, like, if I'm buying futures contracts on players, like, oh, I'm switching to tournaments from cash games, and, like, I'm starting to think about tournament stuff, and, like, oh, I did well in this tournament, but, like, let me think about this a bit harder. It's like, a lot of the best tournament players start off like that. Like, this is, yeah, I think, well, there's a lot to like here, a lot to like here.
Thanks for writing, Dan. Thanks for listening. Thanks, really, everyone who's listening right now. Certainly would appreciate it if you can rate and review us on iTunes or anywhere else that you find podcasts that enables you to write reviews. That helps us to get a wider audience and have more people listen and enjoy the show, as we hope that you will enjoy our upcoming interview with John Doe.
Well, first of all, I need to point out that I am 89 years old.
Congratulations.
Are you shocked by that?
Well, John told me 87. I guess he was being generous.
Yeah, he was being nice. And I originally come from Canada. I'm both Canadian and American. I grew up in a small French-Canadian town about 50 miles northeast of Montreal. So I started playing cards at a very early age, and I started playing poker, I would guess, when I was about 15 or 14 or 15. And I've been playing poker ever since in various venues. But I never played really as much as I do now. I'm now a widower. My wife died a couple of years ago.
Sorry to hear that.
And whereas I used to play poker maybe for a few hours once a week or something, this is the first time in my life that I play poker for, say, 18 hours at a time. Two days of it. And I do that, well, I would say most weeks. And I do it in a casino, of course. And my former poker playing was mostly social, suburban type of thing. And occasionally, I used to commute between New York and L.A. for quite a while, and I would stop over in Las Vegas. So I've had a lot of poker playing in Vegas at a time when most people didn't drop off. I'm talking about the 60s.
Oh, wow.
And I remember playing at the Dunes in the 60s, where I'm convinced I was being cheated.
I'm also convinced you were being cheated.
There you go. But anyway, I came to Boston in 1978. And I had a social game every Monday night, pretty much, with some very, very good poker players. One of them was a Nobel Prize winner in economics. Oh. He never seemed to lose. And then, to my good luck, Foxwood opened up. And so I became a steady forward at Foxwood. I was there practically, I think, the week after it opened. And I've been playing there off and on since then, which is what, 20 years? Over 20 years ago, I guess.
Yeah, over 20.
But now I play there, like I say, every week. I leave here on Wednesday morning, sleep over, and come back Thursday night. And that's about 18 hours of poker. When I tell my fellow octogenarians over here that I'm doing that, they think I'm either lying or crazy.
I was going to ask you about the first part of that, the Canadian heritage part. My in-laws are Canadian
because of that.
Yeah, And oh, sorry, what part? Saskatoon.
Where from?
Saskatoon.
Oh, Saskatoon. I've never been to Saskatchewan. I've been to Vancouver. I've been to Winnipeg, but I've never been to Saskatchewan.
Ah, it's beautiful. It's beautiful, anyway. Especially if you like flax. But my experience, also growing up in Michigan, my experience with Canada and Canadians is that multiculturalism, it's certainly an American value, but it's not baked into the culture here the way it is there. Especially growing up near Montreal, like government services would be, you know, that they would say hello, bonjour to you probably. And, my sense is that there's like a much more reflexive reaction in Canada to think like, well, maybe this person is coming from a completely different background to what I'm coming from. Would you say that was part of the sort of world you were brought into? And does this have anything to do with your attraction to poker, which is a lot about figuring out where other people are coming from?
No.
Good. No. That's a great answer.
I grew up in a small French-Canadian town called Joliet, 50 miles northeast of Montreal, where, let's assume a population of 15,000, and there were probably 150 English-speaking people.
Okay.
The other 14,850 were all French-Canadians. And so French was really, oddly enough, my first language. And I spoke French with a very marked, I'm sorry, I spoke English with quite a marked accent until I was about 20. And, but that's another story. So I grew up in a small town, and, but my parents liked to play cards. My parents were first-generation immigrants from Romania at World War I. And for some reason, I don't know why, they did like to play cards, to play casino, a game that I haven't heard about since. In any case, and then I went to Montreal because I could not finish high school in Joliet. So I went to Montreal, and I got into some interesting social games with my peers, you know, 16-year-olds, 15-year-olds, and they basically barred me from the game because I was winning too often. And then I went to McGill University at a time right after World War II, when the average age was about 25 or 26. And I lived on campus. So it was very easy to get a poker game going. And I played a lot of poker while I was at McGill and bridge. And that was that, I guess. And then I really didn't play very much for the next maybe 5 years, I guess. I went to Ottawa as a civil servant, and I came back. I went to England to live for some more graduate work. I came back. And then in Montreal, for my second sojourn there, I got myself involved in a regular weekly social game, which just happens, you know. And that was good. That was good. You could lose $50, $100 in those days, maybe just about that. You lost $100, and don't forget, in 1957 numbers, that's a reasonable number.
Yeah.
So I've been playing poker a long time. Then when I came to New York, I could not find a poker game. In 1962, when I came to New York, right through to 1978, the only time I played poker, really, was in Vegas. I couldn't do it. There was, for some reason, where I was living, I could hardly get a poker game. And then I came to Boston, and in 1978, and that's where I found a regular weekly poker game. And then the casino opened up. So I guess I've been playing. That's my kind of poker. Now, I don't consider myself a professional poker player. I just consider myself a reasonably decent amateur. And I'm reasonably wealthy. So playing poker with John, for example, at 75, 150 studs, is for me entertainment. I do not go there to make money. I don't go there to lose money, but I don't go there to make money. I like the group. There are always a few guys that are no good, but by and large, it's a very friendly game, and I've learned to enjoy it, even though on balance I'm a loser. But I know that. I know that. I'm playing against in any one table of eight, or in hold'em or seven card stud. I'm only playing against four professionals. I mean, people who make a living at the game. And I don't pretend to me or to anybody else that I'm as good as they are. But I'm reasonably good. So whatever I lose, it doesn't matter. It's irrelevant to me. So I play for the sake of it. That's all. And if I come in and play, I'm not enjoying it, I'll quit. I mean, there are some people I just hate playing with, and I just won't put up with it. That's not why I go to play poker.
What sort of thing would cause you to not want to play poker with somebody?
Very bad losers irritate me.
Yeah.
And very bad losers who, for some reason, I've never been able to fathom, blame the dealer. I know an individual who gives that dealer such a lousy look if he ends up with the opening to come in, or if he or she gives him a bad cut. I mean, there are all kinds of people who play poker, and some of them just don't know how to lose. And some of them, of course, can't afford to lose. One of the interesting things, by the way, is that over the last 20 years, I've seen about 15 people who started, when we started there, 20 years ago, we used to play 50 and 100. There were no 75, 150 games. There may have been an occasional 50, 150 in hold'em, but 50, 150 was the top you could get at Foxwoods. Well, 15 years later, they're not there anymore. They do not play high-stake poker anymore. Mm-hmm. And I keep telling them, I know a lot of young fellows who play poker, and they play very well. But I keep asking them, do they know any rich, old poker players? They're very few. So I like to play with pros, but they have to behave themselves. Let's put it that way.
Has stud always been your game?
Yes. I only learned about hold'em, I guess, 20 years ago. But nobody used to play hold'em. Mm-hmm. If you go back more than 25 years, you understand that 89 years old, 25 years ago for me, is a short span. So I'm not crazy about hold'em. I do play hold'em. I'll play 20-40 or any higher stake, but I find hold'em a lot easier than stud.
If I'm reading between the lines, it sounds like any amount of money that you lost at 75-150 wouldn't really hurt you too much. Are you ever tempted to play at stakes where you feel like it would be meaningful money to you?
Well, I've thought about that, but at this point, I don't think so. By the way, I could play 150, 300. I could play, if you wanted, 500 and 1,000. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't bother me at all. Do you know anything about my background?
John insinuated a few things.
Other than what I've just told you?
he gave us your resume.
Maybe tell our listeners that you served as executive vice president of American Express, then you were chairman, president, and CEO of the Zaire Corporation. There's more to say than that, but you have a long and distinguished history in business. That's a fair way to summarize it.
My favorite job, though, was being president of the car division of American Express before I was promoted to executive vice president of the company as a whole.
Okay. Well, why did you prefer the car division gig?
Well, I've always preferred to have the line job. That's why I left American Express. I gave up giving the idea of giving advice which may or may not be carried out in 1962. I decided that I was not going to be a staff executive anymore. I had been for previous years. And I said, if I was going to work in American business, I wanted the job where I called the shots. And that was that. So I when I left American Express, I went to be the CEO of the Zaire Corporation. I wasn't looking for a job. I've never looked for a job. But it came up, and that's why I spent the last 10 years of my life teaching at MIT.
In the Sloan School?
I beg your pardon?
In the Sloan School, the business school?
Yeah. I spent 10 years teaching at Sloan.
I think at some point they offered a poker course, didn't they?
Who offered a poker course?
The Sloan School. I think that they had a poker course on their offerings at some point.
Really? Not in my time. Well, maybe. Could be. But I didn't teach a
poker. No, I didn't think you taught it.
No. I taught the corporate strategy. Business strategy in the service industry.
I'm going to apologize in advance for the length of this question, and we'll also get back to what we were talking about. But I'm curious, and I have this question on my list, so here goes. It is sometimes said in poker that playing high stakes is just like playing low stakes. It's just you have to be a bit better at it, but fundamentally it's the same thing. I think if you know what being a poker pro is like, you know that that's false, and that there are sort of specific skills to being a high stakes pro that are not there at lower stakes. So, for example, you can't just carry 10 buy-ins of 100, 200 no limit around with you, or at least not easily. So you have to know how to like get money and deposit money, etc. Certain parts of knowing when the games are going and getting invitations to those games, that's much more important for a high stakes pro. Certain kinds of tilt reduction, you have to be able to learn new games and keep up with whatever the big game in the room might be, etc. So there are qualitatively different skills that go into being a high stakes pro besides just needing to know how to make poker decisions better, sort of first order poker decisions. Similarly, in business, I think one sometimes sees the attitude that being an executive is a lot like being anywhere else on the org chart. You just have to be a bit better at it. But if you talk to executives, they'll tell you that's hogwash and there are qualitatively different things you need to be good at. I can't remember this quote, but somebody said that the most important skill for a CEO, and this was a CEO saying this, is to be able to get good restful sleep on an airplane. And that's not a skill that I need. I was wondering, go ahead.
If I can interrupt for a second.
Please.
Not to get a good restful sleep on an airplane, but not to need sleep.
Good. Are you like that?
Yes, well, I was when I was a young man. How old are you guys?
I'm 36.
I'm 35, yeah.
What's that?
35 and 36.
Oh, you're kids. Well, exactly. When I was your age, I never got tired. Never. I know that sounds like a stupid statement, and it may be a stupid statement, but I didn't know what it was like to feel tired until I was 45. I could work 12-hour days, 8 days in a row. I used to fly around the world the way you go to electoral town. I didn't suffer from jet lag. I've known 100 chief executive officers. I've never known who was successful who was lazy or who could not take hard work. I was a member of the board of directors of American Airlines for 15 years when it was the biggest airline in the world and was run by a guy by the name of Bob Crandall, who has long been considered the best CEO, the best American, best airline CEO in the world. Same thing. Never slept enough, never bothered, could work incredible days nonstop. And I've never known a big, like a tough CEO, a good CEO, who didn't have incredible energy.
So
now I'm talking about CEOs in this S&P 500. I'm not talking about small companies.
Right. Right. So besides extreme work ethic and a certain kind of physical ability to actually do lots of work, what are the characteristics specifically of executives? Like, what is it that makes a good executive that's not just writing a memo better than the person two levels down on the org chart, being a little more charismatic than the person two levels down on the org chart, et cetera?
Well, there are certain attributes that most, I'm not going to repeat the stuff that you get in any Harvard book on management. But there are some things that most professors don't even address. And I probably have read 20 books on what makes a good or a bad CEO. One of them is, if you are in a for-profit company, now we're not talking about CEOs of big hospitals or stuff like that, but if you're a CEO of an S&P 500 or 100 company, you have to get used to the idea, and you don't get there unless you're already used to the idea, that you are being evaluated every 30 days of your life. That the board of directors and your shareholders are looking at your performance all the time. And that takes a certain kind of psychological awareness and fortitude. I've told my children, do not follow me. Because the idea of you being evaluated, did you meet your objective? Did you meet your plan? Did you make the money you said you were going to make? Every 30 days of your life or every quarter of your life, every month, every 3 months, it is bone weary. And if you can't do that, don't do it. If you can't do that, if you cannot take that kind of perpetual inspection of your performance, you're in the wrong place. I consider that to be perhaps one of the most singular characteristics of that is required.
It's a great answer. Thanks.
I will wager you hadn't heard that before.
I have not. I have not. I've read quite a bit though about the quote unquote new economy and how that involves all of us getting measured a lot more than before. So if you're a delivery driver, it used to be that you would pick up your stuff in the morning, then drop off an empty truck at the end of the day, and if not too many complaints came in, you would pick up a paycheck. Now, if you do the same job, you've got a GPS on you at all times, et cetera, et cetera. And similarly for other jobs.
You're on the verge of saying something very important. Really, you are. The technology of performance review is now so much more sophisticated, so much more available to everybody, that what I just described, which did not used to apply to your driver, does apply now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a new world, which thank God I'm not involved with. But it is becoming, let me put it this way, there's no place to hide.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's a terrible burden for young people, guys. And I suggest that most people can't take it.
Yeah.
Which leads to great unhappiness.
Would you say that this is maybe an underrated aspect of unhappiness. It's well documented that a lot of people are unhappy, and maybe the people are getting less happy. And,
well, I think they're unhappy because they're being looked at through a microphone, through a glass all the time.
Yeah, that's a very interesting answer. People say that sometimes, but they usually focus on, say, social media and the private lives, like the private life dimension of being looked at all the time. I think I think more people should talk about that. But I think more people should talk about that in the public in the professional sphere also. I think you're quite right there, and you would know better than I would. So.
No, I wouldn't. But I'm not a psychologist. My wife was a psychologist, but I'm not. And so I'm guessing here. I'm saying these things based upon my experience and the fact that, you know, at one point I had 50,000 people working in my company. So you have to sort of look at that. Like the productivity of cashiers in a discount department store like Walmart or Target. You can now do that very effectively. 50 years ago, not so effectively. And you can go, you can multiply that example 1,000 times. I have a chauffeur who used to be a Uber driver, and I used to ask him, and I still ask him, you know, how do you get paid and so forth and so forth, and Uber knows exactly what the chauffeurs make or don't make, and where they are. Well, anyway, we'll get me started. Technology has changed the world, and I'm out of it.
I think poker in some ways is kind of the opposite of that, where you're really the only one who knows your results. I mean, the people you're playing with probably have some idea of whether you're winning or losing, but has it been different for you to find that you're the one, or you're kind of the only one you're accountable to when you're playing poker?
Oh, that's right. It's like being in business for yourself. I mean, the professional poker. He has only himself to blame or to praise. You know, he's either good or not. But I have a related question. Why do professional poker players, the good ones, why do they keep playing with themselves? The difference between a very good poker player or 8 very good poker players will only show up over the very, very, very long run. And yet they do play with each other, and they hope to get a guy like me in the game. I know that. I know that. Fortunately, money doesn't matter to me. I have enough of it not to worry about. But there aren't that many guys like me. In my game, in our game at Foxwood, there may be 4 or 5 guys like me in the whole place. And everybody wants us in the game. We all know that. We're not stupid. So that's okay. But now you're talking about maybe 4 pros against, or 5 pros against 3 reasonably good amateurs. Well, they happen to be lucky. But I don't understand it. I mean, the difference between those 4 or 5 pros in my game, very, very slim. Ergo, they're never going to live it. They're playing with themselves. And eventually, it'll take the cost of playing poker. Everything associated with poker will eat them up. And that's why I'm not a full-time poker player. And I was a full-time poker player. That would be a full-time poker player. Look at the television, poker on television. So take a look at the regular hold'em players that all the TV does with. Do you think any one of them is really that much better than the other?
I would say yes. What would you say, Andrew?
I think it varies a lot between what you're watching. But I think in some cases there are some pretty big gaps, but I do appreciate what you're talking about. I think there's a lot of cases where what you're describing is true. I would guess that ego has a lot to do with it.
Ego,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, one moment. I didn't mean to establish this as a universal rule. There is no question that at the very top levels of poker play, the top maybe 50, I don't know how many, 20, 50, 30, 40, they're in the class by themselves. But the other thousands who are good but not super good, there's not that much difference. That's my point. They're not that much different. I'm talking about the journeyman professional. Mm-hmm. The journeyman, I know several guys who just play 20, 40 stubs. They sit there 5 days a week, they play 20, 40 stubs, and if they can make a thousand, they can clear $1,000 a week, I guess, net. I suppose that's over $2,000 a week. That's just as much money as they could make anywhere in their life anyway. But you're not going to get rich.
My conjecture is the following. That they don't keep very good records for themselves, and they don't scrutinize themselves the way they should and the way that they would be scrutinized if they were a cashier at Walmart. And so they play, say, 2,000 hours a year, or maybe more realistically 1,300 hours a year. For about two-thirds of that time, they're not doing much better than breaking even. And the other one-third of that time, the game is very good, and they make the vast majority of their money, but their records aren't good enough, and they don't realize that. And the variance is so big that it doesn't feel like, especially in a game like Stud, their swings in that first two-thirds of the time are so big that it's very easy to mask that fact. So, for example,
You're dead right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I have a favorite thing. When I play Stud with these guys, and I'm playing against six professionals, and there's one other amateur and I, and if I start winning, you know, extensively, I look at them and I say, listen, guys, look how much I've improved my game in the last hour.
That's fantastic.
So, yeah.
I might have to steal that. That's really good. How do you take it? I mean, so you've mentioned a few times that you're aware that, you know, in some cases those players are kind of playing hoping that, you know, so that there will be a game going when someone like you shows up who's willing to play, you know, knowing that you're going to lose something when you play. How do you feel being on the receiver? I mean, it's, some people might find that kind of predatory or insulting.
Oh, no, I don't. I all my life, I prefer to play or work with people who were superior to me. I played tennis for 50 years, and the only games of tennis I enjoyed were with people who beat me all the time. Not all the time, but most of the time. And that was true in all my sports. When I left Canada, I left a food chain of about one of the largest food chains in Canada, and it was a good company. It was run by an individual who owned the company, actually. But when I came to the United States, I came to work with J.C. Penney, and that's a long story which I won't go into. But one of the reasons I came, only one, was that I said to myself, well, if I'm going to sell my soul to the devil, and I thought in those days that working for any corporate enterprise was selling your soul to the devil. You must remember, I'm an old left-wing economist. And I said, well, I might as well go where the big time is, and that was New York City. And so if you could succeed in New York City, in the corporate world of New York City, you can succeed anywhere. It's one of the toughest there is in the world. And I was very lucky. I did succeed in Manhattan. But that was me. I've always preferred to be in a highly competitive environment. That's it. That's why I play poker with guys who were better than me.
What, I mean, if you're describing it as selling your soul, why did you choose to do it?
Oh, when I was younger, when I was in college, undergraduate, and I went to McGill and got my bachelor's there, and I went to Columbia and I got my master's there in economics in both places. Mm-hmm. And then I went to London School of Economics in London, England to continue. I did not get my PhD, but I did everything good but get it. Mm-hmm. That's because I got my... In any case, that was a... those days I was pretty left-wing. Let's put it that way.
But I understand.
When I was an undergraduate at McGill, I was an executive of the Canadian... Well, you know, old enough. But have you ever heard of the CCF?
What's
the CCF?
No.
That's the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation. It was the Social Democratic Party in Canada.
What's something about economics that the public doesn't understand well enough?
No, that's too broad a question.
All right.
Nowadays, economics is broken up in so many different sections of specialization. You know, that's too hard. I don't know the public. I don't know if I buy your premise. Many people think of economics as a dismal science, you know, or like it used to be called. And because you very hard to prove anything in economics. Mm-hmm. And so many businessmen, many very smart businessmen have no use for economists. Mm-hmm. Some do, some don't. Mm-hmm. They think the economists can mislead. One of them is our president.
Do you find any similarity? I mean, you mentioned teaching business strategy. Does any of that strategy cross over in obvious or not so obvious ways to poker strategy?
No, not for me. Maybe for others, but not for me. Because I don't think that bluffing at the higher echelons of American industry or Canadian industry or anywhere is good for you or the company. Mm-hmm. And risk-taking is different at those levels than risk-taking in poker. I mean, you might have a very good hand, you might have a very poor hand, but depending on the personality of the person you're facing and whether he's making money or losing money or his temperament at that particular time, there are times to bluff and there are times not to bluff. In business, you shouldn't bluff. You shouldn't bluff. That's a big difference. Mm-hmm.
If my two favorite books about business executives are first The Outsiders, which for our listeners is a set of six biographies of extraordinarily successful business executives, CEOs, and second, Andy Grove's book High Output Management, which is just Andy Grove writing about how to manage effectively. It's wonderful. If I like those two books, can you recommend a different one or tell me that I'm wrong to like the books that I like?
Oh. Not really. And that's because of my age. I remind you guys that I left MIT in the year 2001. That's approximately 17 years ago. I haven't read much in the way of management literature since then. While I was at MIT, I must have read 100 books on management, but not since. So I can't opine on that. The only thing I can say for sure is that Grove was obviously one of those excellent CEOs, an excellent individual, a brilliant intellect. And I've heard of the book, but I have not read it. But I'm sure without reading it that it's pretty good. Yeah, I've always been a great admirer of Andy Grove.
Yeah. It's really wonderful. Truly, truly... truly exceptional book.
Yeah, I don't doubt that, but I have not read it. Yeah. I gave up reading books for a long time. I mean, management books after I left, and there's a particular reason for that. Do you want to hear it?
Yes.
At MIT, when I went there, they hired me because I'd had 40 years or so of business experience. I had been an economist, but that was unusual to get a former economist who really became a senior business executive. So I could combine the two But more importantly, they felt that I had, because of that combination, they didn't have anybody else at MIT who had that combination. There are a lot of brilliant economists at MIT. In my time, there were 3 Nobel winners. But they never worked for a living. I mean, I'm not sure they could manage a hot dog stand. But they were brilliant in their own fields. Paul Samuelson, one of the world's most famous economists, was there. I knew him. A great guy, but I'm not sure I'd give him a hot dog stand to buy it. And they knew that. And they had tried that by an experiment with guys like me in previous years, and they always failed because these guys, these ex-CEOs, would stick around for a year and then they had nothing else to say. And they weren't really willing to work as a professor should to teach. I was. And so lo and behold, they were surprised that I ended up spending 10 years. And when I left, they actually wanted me to stay. But I decided not to. But so that's unusual to have. And I knew also service industries. I had been in commercial banking, airlines, and retailing. And that's a rather oddball mixture. And at MIT, you know, you're either a physicist or engineer or a mathematician, scientist of some kind. Not too many guys like me. So that's what I did.
Yeah, it's one hears as a piece of business advice or career advice that it's very, very hard to be the best in the world at one thing, and it's very hard but not quite as hard to be really good at two things, but being really good at two things is likely to make you irreplaceable somewhere or much, much better than your competition somewhere. Do you view your academic business school experience as a truth of that? I mean, of course, you were very, very near the top as a CEO, but is one way to rephrase what you just said as an example of this career advice that you didn't need to be the very, very best economist if you also had something else that in combination with your economics background made you unique?
Yes, and vice versa. In other words, you could be a better CEO if there's something in your background that helps you to be a better CEO. Yeah. For example, empathy with people. If you don't have empathy with people in the business world, it's hard to get to the top. In the academic world, it's full of eccentric geniuses who are afraid to talk to you. So you're right. The answer is yes.
The poker world is also full of some eccentric geniuses like that.
Is the poker world like that?
I think we've got more than our share of the eccentric genius type. John suggested a question or two for you, if you don't mind another 10 minutes or so.
If the phone still works.
He was curious, what's your favorite thing about the Wednesday-Thursday stud game as opposed to, you know, other poker games that you've played throughout your life? What do you like about that group of people in particular?
They're very good. They're a higher level than most. Higher levels of skill than most. Mm-hmm. Also, we play for more money than most of my social games.
And that's more interesting for you, even though that money's not really going to make a big difference to your life?
No, makes no difference to my life at all. But I reached a point where I'm too bored to play, you know, 20, 40 stud. It just bores me to tears.
Well, I guess, why is it more interesting to play 75, 150 if, you know, either way it's not really going to affect you financially?
Because if you lose $10,000... it's a little bit more than losing $1,000. And that's all I can say. I know a half a dozen very rich men, much richer than I am. Mm-hmm. I'm talking with real rich. I'm not real rich. And they play only penny ante games. because no amount of money means anything to them.
Right.
So they might as well play for 50 cents and a dollar.
Is there anything that
you... On the other hand, I know some very rich men who play some very high-stakes games.
Yeah. John also mentioned that he thought the quality of conversation in that game was very good. Do you find it an interesting group of people to spend your time with?
Oh, I am amazed at the amount of sports knowledge these people know. It's incredible what they know about baseball, football, hockey, you name it. Well, first of all, there are several fellows there who are bookies. And so that goes without saying, but it's amazing. Even people who are not bookish, I mean, they just know everything about these games. I don't. I'm an absolute ignorance. I just listen. It's amazing. I've told two fellows who I think are very good poker players, and they're both pros. I said, you know, you guys took a wrong turn in the road, because with your knowledge and your ability to handle math, you shouldn't be playing poker. You should have gone to industry. And they all agreed, but they said that didn't work out.
What would be your advice for someone who was successful at poker who wanted to go into industry?
I don't have any advice. If you're 40 years old or 50 years old, it's too late. If you're 25 years old or 30 years old, and there are zillions of them now who really, you know, they play poker online all the time and so forth and so forth. They know the odds as well as, my goodness, any computer can do it. Those people should go into other lines of work, like, you know, whatever, operations research, NASA, you name it. They should go where their proclivities go. And if you're good enough to eventually know all the mathematics of poker and all of the odds of poker, then you should be doing something else.
Do you say that mostly because
they don't.
Something else would be more lucrative, or do you think there are other reasons they should?
Oh, no, not because of the money. But because I don't think of poker as a particularly high... I mean, poker is for me to enjoy, not to make a living. Right. I just don't think, unless you're, you know, like I said, you see these old guys on television. I just don't believe the average poker player can earn a decent living. I mean, unless you consider a decent living, say, $100,000 a year, which I don't.
Have you ever thought about starting a game, or is there a game at your independent living facility?
Yes. 25, 50 cents.
Not interesting to you?
Yeah, they all know I play poker here, but their envy is not because of the stakes. Their envy is that I got away for 2 days. They cannot believe that I can spend 18 hours playing poker in 2 days. And I can't believe it either.
I'm impressed. I'm not sure I can. I mean, I've done it, but I don't enjoy it that much.
Ah, well, I do other things. I play bridge. So I play bridge about 3 times a week. So between bridge and poker, I have enough time to get away from here. By the way, this is a very nice place. So,
Nate, any last questions from you?
No, I mean, I could ask him questions all day, but thank you very, very much. You've been a great guest. Really appreciate you taking the time, and I hope to see you at the table someday.
Well, okay then.
Thank you again. Honestly, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks very
much.
Bye. Take care.
Take care.
Bye.
Devotion of a Carmelite, the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you won't.